Dit is Toogpraat met Tom van Grieken. Een unieke politiek incorrecte podcast. Geen taboes, geen woke onzin. Gewoon een gesprek. Opgelet, sommige meningen kunnen kwetsen en dat is niet ons probleem.
Welkom bij een nieuwe uitzending van Toogpraat met Tom. De gast deze keer is een internationale gast. En het is een hele eer om die man hier vandaag te mogen ontvangen. Hij was meer dan 20 jaar Europarlementslid. Eerst voor UKIP, dan voor Brexit, maar altijd voor de Britten. Hij is een man met een klare visie, een duidelijke missie. Een man die zijn droom ook tot waarheid heeft zien komen. Een man die niet te stoppen was. Zelfs een vliegtuigcrash heeft hem niet kunnen tegenhouden. Hij is een man die ooit Herman Van Rompuy een natte dweil heeft genoemd en zei dat hij charisma heeft van een tweede rangs bankbediende. Hij heeft zich daar trouwens ook voor verontschuldigd bij al die bankbediendes, maar niet bij Van Rompuy. Hij is een man die de nachtmerrie was van Guy Verhofstadt en Juncker. Hij is een man die zijn politieke droom heeft realiteit zien worden. Hij is een man die altijd democratie en soevereiniteit heeft verdedigd. Hij is Mr. Brexit. Niemand minder dan Nigel Farage is mijn gast bij Trover. Nigel, van harte welkom. Nice to meet you here at the podcast. It's called Toogpraat. Translated, it's like a bar talk or something.
Perfect. So, just exactly right for me.
Yeah,
I love it.
I guessed it would be perfect for you. So maybe interesting as well is we start this podcast each time simply asking a non-political question to my guest. What's your favorite drink?
Well, I like a beer and I like wine, but I do enjoy a gin and tonic. And I notice, appropriately, you've chosen Poppy's Gin. And of course, the 1418 War, the British, Flanders, the fact that it's the 11th of November is upon us. So in every regard, Tom, I think you've got this absolutely spot on.
Thank you very much.
Well done, you, and cheers.
Cheers.
Thank you very much.
Gin tonic and a link with Flanders.
Ronde 1, wat zal het zijn? De gast legt Tom een vraag voor.
Our listeners know it. Our first round, you have a question for me. So, Mr. Nigel, what's your question for me?
Yeah, I mean, I came here in 1999. That was my first Eurostar to Brussels, to come into the European Parliament, an independence campaign for the UK, out of the EU. Everybody said it was impossible, you know, like pushing water uphill. We'd never achieve it, and we did. And I always thought we could. And I've seen lots of political movements around Europe. Your one interests me because, you know, Belgium's an invention.
It is.
You know, it is not a nation.
It is not.
With a sense of unity of purpose. I completely get the Flemish bit, the Flemish art. You know, I understand, and I've known you for many years, known the party for many years, and you've got elected representation right across Belgium amidst this very complex system that's emerged here. My question is, do you really think you can win?
Yes, I truly believe so. I truly believe so. And if I wouldn't believe in the victory of my party and the end goal of getting a Flemish independent state where we can protect our own Flemish people, then I would not be into politics. As you might know, in 2014, our party was very small and nobody believed in our party. Yeah. We're completely crushed by the NVA, a semi-conservative party. And they sent me into the field. The journalist called me a child soldier, the last one to close it down. And I had not the biggest plan, but I truly believe the story that we're told, that we tell as Vlaams Belang, is an important story. How are we going to get there? It will go with ups and downs. It will not be a quick victory.
But you believe?
I do believe. If you don't believe in your ideology, in your the things you say, if you don't believe it, you will not convince people. I truly believe you don't have to be the best charismatic speaker or something. People can simply tell, looking at the telly or seeing a politician, what he says he truly means.
Yeah,
if it comes from the heart or from the head, that's the difference.
Because there are two types of people in politics. There are those who want to be something and those who want to do something. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people get tempted by rank, title, position. Mm-hmm. And when they get to that stage, they lose purpose of what the main goal is. But I think, no, look, I believe you. I think you've got it very clearly still.
I have a little speech. I go when I go to pubs and local divisions of our party. And I always say there's a difference between parties like ours and other parties. If you want to become mayor or minister, I can advise you a lot of other parties to become member. But if you become member of my party, then you don't do it for yourself in your personal career. You do it for a purpose because you had enough of it. You have enough of the political elite. You have enough of all the bullshit in the media. You don't do it for yourself. You do it for your children.
So it's a cause.
It's a cause. It's something you're called to do. And it doesn't matter what the prize is. You have to do it. You get up in the morning and you have to do it. When young people, and I'm still young, but even younger than me, ask me, Tom, should politics be something for me? I always ask them, is politics, doing politics, a hobby for you? When they say yes, I say, then I think you misinterpret what the whole idea of politics is. A hobby is going like fishing. You do it when you have time and when you want to do it. Politics is a passion. Even if I have a bad day, I want to do politics. The first thing I wake up is doing politics. The last thing I think about when I go to bed is politics. It has to be a passion 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Yeah, and I have to say, you know, I had that belief in what I did, and it just took a lot longer than I hoped it would.
You got your independence way quicker than we do. We're stuck in Belgium for more than 200 years now. And did you ever had any doubt during your political career?
I had doubts whether I could keep on doing it. I mean, it's hard. It's hard. You know, we all have down moments, of course. There are the dips, there are the failures along the way. And you think
there are the betrayals, always.
Yeah. And you think, well, look at the cost of this to everything, and time, and life, and business career. Obviously, I had some doubts along the way, moments of doubt along the way. But I never doubted overall that I was doing what I believed in, and that I had to do it. I had no choice.
Yeah, I get my. Of course, I'm not always a strong person, or I pretend to be. But when I go to talk to normal people, and they talk about the misery they have. They have to go to work in a shitty job and they have to pay bills they cannot afford and something. Yeah. That's hard work. Mm. That's really hard. And that we have a bad week or a bad month and perception is a bit against us, we get over it. Our egos are big enough to fulfill that. And it's very heavy for our families and our children, of course. But at the end, going each day to the factory, that's even harder than being a politician.
There are lots of people out there doing jobs that they have no passion for at all. And as you say, we have bad days and bad weeks, but we always have. But the passion's always there.
Always there. You know, a little thing when I talk to people, what's the difference between our party and the left-wing party? I always say there's also a funny thing that we should learn from the left-wing parties. All there. When a left-wing person enters a room, you know what, they always think everybody's in favor of them. If a liberal comes there, open borders, globalization, European Union, amazing. And somebody says, I disagree on you. They're generally surprised. How can you not agree with us? And when a right-wing person or patriot or a nationalist enters a room, with all of people think everybody's against us. Mm. And I make the complete switch. If I have a bad day, I say, on a bit naive side, everybody is in favor of us. We are the good guys. We defend the things who are very important. Sovereignty, democracy, our own country. And I think that also makes a difference on bad days, that we defend the things that are important. Equality of women, men and women, freedom of speech and so on. Those are things which make it worth going for.
Yeah, no, well, keep going. Because you've made great progress in the last few years. And I think you've got a good couple of years coming up. I really do.
Let's hope so.
No, I do.
Time for the second question. Round 2.
Yeah.
Ronde 2. Pak er een van mij. Tom heeft een vraag voor de gast.
Now, Mr. Farage, if we believe what all the mainstream media says in Belgium, then Brexit is a complete disaster. There are no groceries anymore in the supermarkets. It is terrible. It's the worst place to live in. Is it really so terrible in Great Britain at this moment?
Well, it's called inflation. So what's happened during this pandemic, and indeed was happening from 2008, is we've massively increased money supply. Government has created a lot more money. And that money, as we come out of the pandemic, is chasing the same number of goods and services. That leads to shortages, higher prices, and at times, empty shelves. So this problem is far from unique to Britain.
Yes.
If you look at America, the West Coast of America, hundreds of ships out of Long Beach, California, you know, unable to dock, labor shortages. Canada's got similar problems. Poland's got a bigger shortage of lorry drivers than we've got.
Oh, is it?
They're
all working in the UK.
Well, that's what they say. I mean, they say they've all gone home, but actually, Actually, over 6.3 million EU citizens have registered to stay in Britain. It's an incredible number. So, no, this is a global problem, but it is a symptom of inflation that's about to come. Are the French making things slightly difficult at ports to get goods in and out? Well, more difficult than it was before, but I wonder whether we need to perhaps rebalance our routes, mm-hmm. become a bit less dependent upon Calais. Who knows? The one or two North Sea ports,
I can, Eastern Channel
ports
that, Bruges, Antwerp,
that might want some of that business. It might not be quite as quick as Dover-Calais, but I'm sure it could be priced competitively. And where there is a problem is Northern Ireland. Northern Ireland, there is a problem. There is a problem getting supplies into Northern Ireland from the mainland, and that's because the treaty that we signed with the European Union, and you could interpret it how you want. I think Boris Johnson was just desperate to get it over with and kind of sold out Northern Ireland a bit. But so we're now re-examining that. So Northern Ireland has a problem getting goods. For the rest of the UK,
it's quite okay.
It's like the rest of the Western world.
So actually, you have the international thing, inflation, but also the bad deal of Boris Johnson, which...
For Northern Ireland, yeah.
So actually better still a no deal than a bad deal of Boris Johnson.
Oh, look, I think a no deal would have been far better than what we've got. I mean, financial services was a no deal, and yet money from EU countries is still pouring into the City of London. Yeah. And we're doing proportionately more European business than we were before with no deal. So, but look, we've got what we've got. I mean, there was a period for 3.5 years when it looked like Brexit could be stolen from us. Now, luckily, we had the opportunity through what Mrs. May did. We had the opportunity with the Brexit Party to come back in 2019 to get rid of her as Prime Minister, which for me was a big moment, a wonderful moment, because she'd betrayed the whole thing.
Yeah.
And that allowed Boris in. So it's not a perfect deal, but in many ways it's good. And our recent tie-up with Australia, where we're now going to sell them nuclear submarines, mm-hmm. as opposed to the French selling them diesel submarines. You know, hey, we're 21st century Britain, and you guys are increasingly becoming the 20th century European Union. So I think we're in the right place in many, many regards.
Okay. Would you, for example, we also have a lot of criticism on the European Union. Would you recommend each country to leave the European Union, or are there reasons why some countries should stay in it?
You cannot be an independent, self-governing, democratic nation and a member of the European Union. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can be an adjunct of the European Union, but you have to accept the supremacy of EU courts. You have to accept that once EU law passes through the European machine and becomes national law, there's nothing at the next general election any voter can do, any parliament can do to change any of it. So ultimately, yes. I mean, one of the reasons I was so hated here was not because I wanted just for the UK to leave. I want Europe to leave the European Union. I'd love us to have a European of close trade and cooperation,
so,
run through the nation state.
What European was before the Maastricht Treaty was something you could live with, or is that something?
I think already with the Single European Act, it had gone quite a long way. Mm. But Maastricht was the open politicisation. Maastricht was the introduction of a flag. Anthem, the word union as opposed to community. You know, Maastricht was a big watershed in all of this. But a Europe of close trade and cooperation, do you know what? If we had that amongst sovereign nation states, we might even rejoin.
Yeah, I understand.
Because if it doesn't mean surrendering sovereignty and it means common sense deals with neighbours, that'd be fine.
Yeah, it's not the best.
But it isn't going to happen. It isn't going to happen. There's no way these structures in Brussels, these glass and steel buildings, these are not going to be reformed. This whole thing has to be brought down.
When Britain left European Union, you might think that the European elite would think, maybe we're doing something wrong, but they did the complete opposite.
More
European Union.
Absolutely.
The crazy people like Guy Verhofstadt, if Europe is doing good, they say, we need more European Union. Mm. When Europe is doing bad, the solution is also more European. There is no alternative and always more European Union.
The same as the Soviet Union.
It's terrible.
The same as when things were going wrong in the Soviet Union.
More Soviet Union.
More Soviet Union.
It is terrible.
That's exactly the same thing that's happening here. Look, I honestly, you've got the North-South split. The Euro works for Germany, and it works for these countries. It works for Belgium. It's not a problem. It involves a loss of sovereignty, but it's not an economic problem. For the Mediterranean, it's a disaster.
It's terrible.
And, you know, Greece, Italy, it's done Spain
they
no
favors. They
can't
devaluate their currency, so they're a product country. They have
they're
to produce.
Stuck.
And
they're
now
stuck.
They have the it's terrible. It's, you know, it's killing those simple
And now
people.
We've got the East-West split.
Yeah.
The cultural problem. The very uber-liberal West and the traditional Roman Catholic center of Europe, and we always call them Eastern Europe, but actually look at a map.
Central.
Look at a map. Prague is bang in the middle of Europe, and Moscow, and Warsaw's not far away. And so you've got that split as well. You know, whether it's Poland that is now on a collision course with Brussels, I just don't know which country it'll be. But ultimately, I don't think it's a good thing for the European peoples. I don't think it's a good thing for European democracy for this system to survive as it is. It's dreadful.
And if you talk about the division between East and West, maybe history repeats from time to time. You have something like the Roman Empire, where the Eastern Roman Empire is actually the real Roman Empire who still existed. The real Europe will exist in the East, and in the West we will decline completely. Is it a possibility?
Well, I think that decline's happening anyway. I think that if you look at the relative position of the European Union against the rest of the world, mm-hmm. Just take global GDP as one measure. With every year that goes by, Europe's proportion of global GDP falls by at least 1%.
It's terrible.
So it's down to 14-15% now of global the Eurozone of global GDP. By 2030, it'll be well under 10%. Mm-hmm. And yet, everybody here in Brussels,
you're going great.
They think this is it. This is the ultimate that mankind has ever achieved. They're deluded. They don't know what's going on in the real world. And part of Brexit, unlike the, it's little England, it's backward thinking, it's the 1950s. No. It's not. Actually, global Britain now has an opportunity to reach out and embrace much, much broader relationships around the world than we ever could do in the European Union. We've done that deal with Australia. I mentioned that already. Mm-hmm. I arrived here in Brussels today to go into a restaurant. I was asked to produce a vaccine passport. The same applies.
Ridiculous.
Not in London.
And what's the vaccine rate in London? In Britain, what's the percentage of people who got a vaccine? Approximately?
We're about 88%.
Okay, we're in Flanders 92, and still the state doesn't trust the people. It's terrible to see here.
Yeah, I we've got healthcare sector where it's becoming mandatory.
Yeah, it's terrible.
A lot of people won't do it. Look, I don't think Boris Johnson has handled it very well, but we're not as authoritarian as the rest of Europe or much of the rest of the world. So in relative terms, we're doing okay. But the irony is, as we're coming out of this pandemic, governments are grabbing even more power.
Yeah, it's true.
And I understand there's even a member of the European Parliament not being allowed access to the building.
Yes, it's democracy. You use a pandemic, human tragedy, to gain grip on democracy. It's a state who knows everything about the people, but it's not the people who know everything about the state. It's something very dangerous.
I've taken the vaccine. I think the evidence is quite clear that if you do get COVID, and I'm nearing 60, I've smoked all my life, it makes sense for me to have it. If you get COVID, you're less likely to be seriously ill. What I'm not convinced of is having the vaccine makes you any less likely to transmit the virus.
No.
And when I ask scientists that question, I get a variety of answers. So it should be about personal choice. And if we use this to create a two-tier society where 8-10% of our populations are literally excluded from normal life, that'd be a mistake.
You talked about all the nurses and so on who could lose their job if they're not vaccinated. It's very tragedy. 2 years ago, we were applauding. They were the heroes.
I know.
And now they're pointing their fingers. You, when you had no vaccine, you were a hero. And now you don't have a vaccine. For what reason whatsoever, we should fire you. It's a bloody, bloody shame. It's a disgrace.
Yeah. No, government gets bigger and bigger. Yeah. Our individual choices become fewer and fewer. And this is an ongoing fight for liberty. It's very important.
Okay. Round 3.
Ronde 3. Wie gaat de rekening betalen?
Right.
What is the biggest danger we're facing as a society?
There are two dangers, really. One is obviously completely uncontrolled immigration, changing the demography of our countries completely, and in a way that's not reconcilable, that leads to divisions. And if I was to dwell on this, I'd say there are parts of Brussels now where there are communities living entirely separate lives to other parts of Brussels, and that's not good, that's not healthy, it poses security threats and all the rest of it. But that in a sense is almost worthy of a big podcast of its own right. But it is one issue, and if you look at what's happening at the moment on the Belarus border with Poland,
Massive.
2015, when Juncker put in place the European refugee system, I was in the parliament, sitting next to him, arguing, this is insane. You know, if by just setting foot on EU soil you can stay, millions will come, and they did, and they all ignored me. Now, of course, they're panicking. You've got Barnier, of all people.
Yeah, in France.
I mean, wanted to get strict on immigration.
He wants a strict immigration.
Donald Tusk wants NATO to get involved on the border. So they now realise what a real problem this is. I was right about this. I was well ahead of the game on understanding all of this. But this is something that will affect all of us. That's one issue. Mm-hmm. But I think, and it is serious, but the other one I think that is even more fundamental is the battle for the future of Western civilization. We have a civilization based on Judeo-Christian values mm-hmm. and culture. Through that system over centuries, we've built up a form of democracy. We've built up a form of government of the people, by the people. We've built up a series of values in terms of our nations, our histories, the bits we're very proud of, the bits we're less proud of, but we've always accepted they're part of our history. Some of our great Elizabethan characters that helped us forge the way for the empire, I mean, they were pirates. They were villains, they were robbers of the high sea, but that doesn't mean their names aren't important as part of our island story. Churchill may have said things that socially are more difficult today than they were 100 years
but
ago.
But isn't this very easy of the, I call it a woke generation, a political elite, to say with the knowledge they have now, with the luxury they have now, to judge history? They had to do it in times.
And they'll be judged in 100 years.
Yeah.
They'll be judged in 100 years. Yeah. In all sorts of ways, because values change.
The revolution always eats its first children.
Well, of course.
And it will happen.
But never before have we had an attempt to literally abolish our history, to make us ashamed of who we are and what we stand for. And it's happening throughout the educational establishments. It's happening through large sections of the media. It manifests itself. I think the term woke is too soft. It's cancel culture.
Of Marxism.
And behind
cultural
it
Marxism.
Is,
behind cultural it is Marxism.
The virus. Not coronavirus, but Marxism, which mutates and comes back. And they're using, as they use class and money in Russia for the revolution of 1917, they're now using, you know, effectively race. That we must all feel guilty mm-hmm. And that black people must now have special privileges in getting jobs, and we must take the knee to Black Lives Matter, which is an avowedly Marxist organization that wants to defund the police. And a lot of young people are buying into this without thinking. A lot of corporate companies have bought into Black Lives Matter. I did a big event in London last week, 150 business people, and Black Lives Matter became an mm-hmm. issue. And I said to them, this is a Marxist organization that wants to defund the police force, bring down Western capitalism, and end your jobs. And I'm saying this to the very people who say they're supporting it. And they say I'm wrong. Just read the website.
Yeah, you can simply see it.
And it's the ignorance of all of this. So I think the battle for Western civilization, because if we don't fight that battle, and win a battle that says that we believe in our values, we believe in what we are, where we come from, and we're optimistic for our future. If you don't fight that and believe that, then actually the other cultural battle of mass immigration, you're never going to win.
Yeah, it's true.
You're never going to win it because you know, unless you're robust in believing what you're about, then you won't have the strength of character to deal with the external problems.
Yeah, the whole idea then that our values, it's, you should be ashamed that you say our values, our the way we live, is superior. If you say, you can't say that. But actually it is, no other point in history, women had more chances than in this society. In no other point in history, we had science at this level, education at a high level.
Health. Healthcare, and quality of life.
And suddenly we have to apologize for that. And that is our system perfect? Of course not. But the whole idea of being self-critical is also something typical Western, because there's no other culture.
But not self-loathing.
Yeah.
And this is self-loathing. And it comes predominantly from upper middle class white people.
Yeah, yeah.
Racked with guilt.
I always say that we have a lot of danger in society. And as you might know, if you're a Vlaams Belang, we always talk about mass immigration, Belgium, Islamization. But the biggest threat is the self-hate. That's the biggest threat you have. If you don't believe in yourself, you cannot convince other people.
One of my biggest slogans for Brexit was believe in Britain.
Yeah.
Because all our leaders said, we're not big enough to govern ourselves. We're not good enough to govern ourselves. We're too small to govern ourselves. We had an empire, but it's all gone, and we now need to be. I mean, they didn't believe in Britain.
That's true.
And our optimistic message was believe in Britain, believe in yourselves, believe you can do this. And it's that same kind of positivity that needs to come through the cultural stuff all around civilization.
But Nigel, the whole thing, of course, if believing in yourself, then you have to have, then you need something to have in common. And the whole thing, of course, if all Brits stick together and they're all Brits and have something in common. But because of mass immigration, we don't live together, we live separately. I always say because of mass immigration, yeah, the logical thing then, if you don't have common values, you need a strong state to obligate certain values or certain rules. So that's a problem. Second of all, I would say believing in what you call the virus, the Marxist virus, multiculturalism, it's also a Marxist thing.
Yeah.
Then that's simply a racist theory. Because the left always say they define people because of their race and where they come from. Multiculturalism is always dividing people. And when national and patriotism
identity politics is poisonous.
It's terrible.
Yeah, either we treat everybody as the same or we're in for a bad future. Dividing everybody up on the grounds of race, gender, sexuality is a mistake.
But you can say there's a common idea you have as a society, a common culture, and so, and that can be different from others. Our Western culture, English culture, Flemish culture, those are as a collective, but on a different level than individual separation. I think that's also something very important, that we're not individuals all, but we have something in common, which is a common language, common history, common
future. Things that bind us together.
Yeah.
And when things bind you together, you have communities.
Yes.
And when people have communities, they actually care for each other. And when people care for each other, the state actually can play a much lower role in our lives. And isn't it interesting, the more we have societal breakdown, the bigger the role of the state becomes. And that doesn't work, actually.
It's terrible. So, Nigel, we have our three rounds.
Yeah.
I have also the last one. It's called in Dutch or in French, it's Tournée Générale. It's, you know, the word, it's like giving a round on a pub. And then my guest may
ring the bell.
I have here one. You can ring it.
Tournée Générale.
And I have a few dilemmas for you.
Okay, here we go.
Are you ready?
Yeah, I'm ready.
Okay. Are you a dog person or a cat person?
Dog. I got a Labrador. Black Labs Matter, by the way. I got a black Labrador at the start of lockdown, and that's why all of these suits need to be taken in, because you have to walk black Labradors. So it's the first dog I've had for years and years and years, and I live in a lovely part of rural southern England, and I've really enjoyed it.
Okay. You have to choose Guy Verhofstadt or Jeremy Corbyn?
Well, I mean, a lot of the things that Jeremy Corbyn stands for, I might find a bit repellent, in particular the sort of anti-Israel, pro-Palestinian terror stuff and all the rest of it. However, Verhofstadt has gone from being a sort of conservative type national politician to being a fanatical maniac. At least Corbyn's been consistent.
Okay.
I may not agree with him.
He has a backbone, which we're not sure about.
But he's been consistent.
Okay.
And so I'm going to have to go for Corbyn.
Okay. Yeah. So a bit Britain first.
But, I mean, Verhofstadt, I mean, just ghastly. I mean, I always say that you can agree with people, that you can like people you disagree with. I like Juncker. I had fun with Juncker. I had laughs with Juncker.
Have drinks with Juncker?
Yeah, of course. You know, I mean, any person that drinks, he drinks more than anybody. But with Verhofstadt, it isn't just that you disagree with him. He's just not very nice either.
We vote him away and he came back in.
I know.
If you have to choose between continental Europe or the United States?
Oh, I'm closer to the USA. I mean, I've worked for European companies. I've been married to a European woman, a German by birth. I love, you know, a lot of French culture. I've spent huge amounts of time in Flanders. I've got a huge interest in the 1418 war, hence the appropriateness of the gin you picked today. So there are many things in Europe I love and want to celebrate, but I love the optimism of America, you know? And also the closeness that it has to Britain.
Okay. And now we're already in the United States. We know you're a big fan of a certain president, but there's also another famous president. So if you have to choose Trump or Reagan?
Oh, that's impossible.
You have to choose.
Such an unfair question. Obviously, I didn't meet Ronald Reagan. I know lots of people that worked for him and did know him. And he was incredibly charming and very successful. I've got to stick with Trump because I'm living him now. But I'm not just living in the now, I'm living in the future, and I want Trump to come back and win in 24. So I've got to go for Trump, but it's a difficult choice.
Yes. And actually, I can recommend all the people to simply go to the US, see him speech, because he's an impressive figure. If you see him only on television, European television, you think, yeah, it's a strange figure. But I've seen him speech, you were there as well at CPAC.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's incredible how
he's phenomenal.
He's phenomenal.
Yeah. And he's a great entertainer as well.
Yeah, he mocks also with himself, but nobody believes it. It's really and it's not. It's more than a person. It's like a phenomenon. It's something bigger than
I promise you, those election rallies, as the run-up to the 8th of November last year happened, and because of coronavirus, indoor events were banned. So it was these all held at airports, and there'd be 30, 40,000 people in the freezing cold, bitter winds. You know, an Air Force One appears on the horizon, and the music starts to play, and Addy gets with the big coat and the hat, and he walks up this long, sort of 75-meter ramp to get to the microphone. And he does his stuff. And then as he leaves, he's pointing at people in the crowd. And there were some nuns in Pennsylvania. Nuns in the front row. And after he'd finished, he looked down and he pointed. He shouted to them, "Sisters, is God with me?" It's just wonderful stuff. I mean, he's a showman like no other. And you're quite right. You have to see it and experience it. And it is quite something.
And if it's not election time, you go to the football in America. Now they're shouting, "Let's go, Brandon," which is it's amazing how they hate Biden.
Well, Biden's popularity is down the floor.
Yeah.
Harris, the VP, has got the lowest VP ratings ever. And the Republicans have got a massive chance in the midterm and a big chance to come back in 24. So
let's hope so.
Yeah, he's Donald may be down, but he's not out.
Okay. Then... speaker in a pub or speaker in Parliament?
I spent years speaking in pubs, and I'm doing that with you today. I'm not sure I'd be very good as a speaker or a chair. I could try, but I think my passions for subjects would make it very difficult for me
to be quiet,
to be a proper neutral umpire. And I'm disgusted in the European Parliament that the speaker, the chairman of the Parliament, is allowed to vote.
Yeah.
The chairman of the parliament is allowed to give opinions. That isn't how it should be.
No.
A reputable chamber picks one of its own number to be a neutral umpire for proceedings. And, you know, if it ever happened that I got into that position, I'd do my best, but I think I'd find it very difficult because I believe in things too strongly.
Football or rugby?
Well, I was brought up with rugby.
You played it?
Yeah, I went to a rugby school. It wasn't my best sport. I was more of a cricketer, golfer, hockey player, those sort of things. So I wasn't great at rugby, but culturally, I was brought up with rugby.
Okay.
And although I do, I mean, having said that, you know, I follow the Premier League, I follow the results every week, our family support Crystal Palace, and we're 10th in the table, which for a small club's not bad.
A traditional club.
But yeah, oh, still a proper old-fashioned football
club,
you know. But actually, the truth of it is, I love all sports.
Okay.
I follow everything. I mean, when the Olympics is on, any international global sport that's on. I was at the Anthony Joshua fight boxing the other week.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, I like attending sporting events. I'm actually a bit of a sports nut.
Okay. Then, Allo Allo or Dad's Army?
Oh, well, both are, of course, written by the same, or at least co-written by the same people. Both brilliant, both utterly hilarious.
But you have to choose.
But I have to choose Dad's Army.
That's how
I I just do. I think there is something. I mean, Allo Allo's good because it takes the mickey out of every European nation. It does it beautifully. But there's something particularly unique in Dad's Army about our ability to laugh at ourselves during our darkest hour.
Oh, yeah.
I like that. Yeah. I like that.
Then the final dilemma, England or Britain?
I would have always said Great Britain. I would have said that without thinking. Yeah. For the first 40 years of my life, always said I was British first, English second. I feel there's a bit of a change coming on, and I'm feeling my Englishness much more strongly than I did before. And I think that's partly because the Scottish nationalism, which isn't really nationalism because they want to be governed from Brussels anyway, it's a sort of strange anti-English globalism. It's very odd. But I think the rise of Scottish...
It's not that odd. The whole world was at one point against Great Britain.
Well, that's true. Because we, well,
that's not
well,
that unique,
well,
of course.
Yeah, but then we ran half of it. there is a resurgence of Englishness. And, you know, we by population are 87% of the UK. And we've had too little of a voice. So, on balance, still British, just... But the Englishness thing could overtake it in the next couple of years.
Maybe a bonus one, because we talked before this podcast, yeah, of course, at a nice lunch together. Thatcher or Churchill?
Well, I you know, historically, Churchill was there at a remarkable time. But if you take out the war years, Churchill's legacy to British politics wasn't a particularly good one. He got a lot of things wrong. Margaret was an utterly transformative figure. And she took us out of the mess that we were in. I mean, the real losers of World War II were us. You know, we came out finished, ruined, bankrupt. We didn't recover. But the mid-1970s, we were the sick man of Europe. And you guys were all doing quite well, relatively well. We were doing terribly. And Thatcher completely transformed the country, brought back some positivity, some entrepreneurship. So for her overall contribution to British politics, Thatcher.
Okay. What a surprise. I thought you would say Churchill.
Churchill, in terms of global history...
Historically, Churchill.
In terms of global history, it's Churchill. But in terms of the way we live our lives in the United Kingdom and her transformative nature of her politics, it's probably Thatcher.
Okay. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening.
It's a pleasure.
Dit is Toogpraat met Tom van Grieken. Een unieke politiek incorrecte podcast. Geen taboes, geen woke onzin. Gewoon een gesprek. Opgelet, sommige meningen kunnen kwetsen en dat is niet ons probleem.